So let's cultivate our motivation. So we can really see quite clearly in our own minds if we stop and recognize it, that our projections on people and things really create our experiences, and that actually things are and people are empty of any inherent existence, any inherent identities or inherent qualities. So how can we see that? Well, we have a friend. We see that friend in a good light, in one way. We trust them, everything that goes with the friendship. And then our friend does something we don't like, or they criticize us about something. And all of a sudden, that person that was a friend that we trusted, that we wanted to be around, suddenly turns into either an annoyance or even an enemy, somebody who's threatening my well-being by criticizing me or harming me. And suddenly, you know, that image we had of that person totally vanishes, and instead a new image of them arises, and we get angry at them. We don't like them. And so it's so strange how our mind works. When we have a positive image, we believe that's 100% true. The person is inherently like that. When we have a negative image, again, we think they're 100% like that. And we identify them like that and feel that way towards them. And in actual fact, from the side of the person, they don't have any of it inherently. From the side of the person, there's simply an I that is merely designated in dependence upon the collection of body and mind. That's it. No findable person, no concrete characteristics. So even if we can get a small feeling for this, then, you know, a lot of our daily angst goes away, because we just see how foolish it is, how it's created merely by wrong conception, by wrong grasping, by fabrication and conceptualization. So we just let go of all that, and instead there's only dependently arising things that we cannot find upon analysis, that's all, including ourselves. And so with the aspiration to understand this and realize it, so that we can free ourselves from all the obscurations that prevent us from being great benefit to sentient beings. With that kind of motivation, then let's share in the Buddha's teachings this evening. So can you get some idea of how your mind's creating a lot of nonsense for you that you believe?
We have our own fake news.
Exactly. We have our own fake news. And just build these things up. Think that person's like this, really like that. And that one's really like that. And then they act completely out of character, and we don't know what to do. You know, oh my God, this person I love, now I don't want to be with him. And this person I can't stand was really kind to me. How do I put this together? I get so confused. And it's all of it is just made up by our mind, you know? Nobody's 100% wonderful. Nobody's 100% awful. Yeah. One person thinks is awful, another person thinks is wonderful. Yeah. So, excellent way to make ourselves suffer. I mean, that's why the Buddha teaches emptiness, isn't it? Okay, try and give us some feeling for this, and so we can release it. And I think this kind of meditation is so needed in a polarized country like right now. You know, this is what we need to do again and again and again. Because one thing that I've started to realize, is that the people who think like me are just as rigid in their thinking as the people who don't think like me. Yeah? And the people who think like me, I thought were always liberal and accepting and tolerant, and until they aren't. Yeah? So what does that say about me? Am I liberal and accepting and tolerant, or am I just as close-minded in being right as the people who don't think like me, who are certain they're right, although we all know they're wrong? Of course, they think the same thing, which shows how wrong they are. Okay? Yeah, no wonder we're all so crazy. Okay. So, I have a list of questions. Venerable Dongcho led the last week's session, and she sent me a summary, and together with some of the issues that came up during it, which I thought I would discuss. Okay, so the first question was, someone asked why conceptual consciousnesses are categorized as impermanence when they wrote meaning generalities. Okay, now I'm going to get on my soapbox. Okay, you people trust books and the vocabulary in books more than you trust oral teachings. Because when it comes to vocabulary, you use the vocabulary in the books, not the vocabulary of the oral teachings. Okay, so what does that say when you are listening to a teaching of His Holiness? And the translator translates something in a different way. Okay? So, because somebody said meaning generalities. Yeah? Is that the term we use at the Abbey? No. What's the term we use? Okay, conceptual appearance. Okay. Do you understand why we use conceptual appearance? Does meaning generality mean anything to you? Does that term make any sense to you? Somebody who's new, Winnie, when you hear meaning generality, do you get any idea of what that means? No. When you hear conceptual appearance, do you get some tiny idea? Okay. So someone asked, why conceptual consciousnesses are categorized as impermanence when conceptual appearances are permanent. Okay. So, yeah, conceptual appearances are consciousnesses, they're minds. Of the three kinds of, no, I'm sorry, conceptual consciousnesses, thank you, are minds, they're consciousnesses. Of the three kinds of functioning phenomena, which one are they? Consciousnesses, okay? Yeah, so they're impermanent. Now, because a mind is impermanent, does it have to perceive something that is impermanent? No. It can perceive something that's permanent, that doesn't change. For example, emptiness. If you were saying because the consciousness is impermanent, then the object has to be impermanent, then understand realizing emptiness is going to be impossible. Yeah? Yeah, you couldn't realize it conceptually or directly. Okay? So just because the consciousness changes moment by moment, yeah, permanent object, you know, that is a conceptual appearance, yeah, because we get at that by negating everything that isn't it, yeah, then that is said to be permanent. And somebody was, in one of the articles I was reading, it was saying like when a baby is learning something and you show a baby a new object, yeah, it's trying to understand it, and what does it do? It starts kind of thinking of everything that it knows already, and, you know, it's not that, you know. And so, well, yeah, kind of somewhat, resembles that. So it's the baby learns it through a negative process. We usually think that we learn things, conceptual minds, through a positive process, that we see things that have similar characteristics and then we put them together. But this other theory is saying, you know, we already have our ideas, and then we take something new and we start comparing it to our ideas, you know, and then we say, it's not that. And then we decide, okay, well, maybe it's kind of like that, and then give it that name, okay? And so, like I said, when I asked the Geshe's in Dharamsala about this, they said, well, another reason it's permanent is because you form an idea about something, and it doesn't change until you have a new experience with that thing. Yeah? Like I was just, the example I just gave, if you have a friend and you have, you know, a conceptual appearance of that friend and what they're like, and that doesn't change until something happens that surprises you. You know, and then you go, oh, they're not like what I thought they were like. Okay, then someone else made a point about inferential cognizers not being direct. Okay, and she said, I responded that inferential cognizers were direct perceivers because I was mixing them up with reliable cognizers. No one corrected me. Okay, so according to Satantrikas, inferential cognizers are not direct because they get at the object by means of a conceptual appearance. Okay, so that's why they're not direct. However, remember at one point we went through the Prasangika system? And Prasangikas say that every moment from the second moment onwards of an inferential cognition is a direct cognizer, because for them, they define direct cognizers as anything that doesn't rely on reasoning. So Prasangikas define direct as in an entirely different way than Satantrikas do. Yeah, so the first moment of an inference would not be a direct cognizer because it depended on reasoning to understand the object. But every moment after that first moment would be a direct cognizer from the Prasangika view, because you're simply seeing what you saw before. So it doesn't depend on a reasoning. Okay, but for Satantrikas, inferential cognizers aren't direct because they're perceiving the object through a conceptual appearance. Okay, so two different definitions of what direct means. And you go, why can't they have just one? You know, so that when I know it, and I don't have to think about it anymore. Well, isn't learning to think about things part of, you know, developing our mind instead of just hearing something and saying, okay, that's it, and not thinking about it any further? Okay. Then, okay, the third one was we were also discussing how the four truths map onto the divisions of selflessness. Okay, so true cessations are permanent. Okay, what about true sufferings, true dukkha? Permanent or impermanent? Impermanent. True causes? Also impermanent. True paths? Also impermanent. Okay. Now they said, but so true causes and true paths, they said, are consciousnesses. Not all true causes are consciousnesses. What are true causes that are not consciousnesses?
Karma.
Well, the karma itself could be the mental factor of intention, or it could be the form, according, you know, that for physical and verbal actions, or it could be the karmic seeds, okay, which are abstract composites. Okay, so yeah, so it's not the case that all true causes are consciousnesses. Okay. Similarly, true paths, yeah, they often include our precepts, our pratimoksha precepts in there. And our pratimoksha precepts, from the viewpoint of some prasangikas, yeah, are not consciousnesses. They are imperceptible form. In this school, yeah, I think they would probably say that, yeah, because it's only the vibhasikas and prasangikas that accept actions of body and speech and pratimoksha precepts as imperceptible forms. The satantikas don't. Okay, so then there was a question somebody asked, is karma an abstract composite? What do you say to that? No, I just asked, is karma an abstract composite? Answer yes or no. I just said it.
You said sometimes it is.
Karmic seeds are abstract.
I said karma can be the mental factor of intention, which is consciousness, or according to the Vibhasikas and the Prasangikas, it could be imperceptible form. No, karmic seeds are abstract composites. So actually we have to be careful when we're talking about seeds, because we say the negative karmic seed of killing. The karmic seeds are not virtuous or non-virtuous. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying the negative how do we sometimes say it? The negative seed of karma, you know? Mm-hmm. It's the seed of negative karma, okay? Because the seed, even if it's, you know, if you do a virtuous action, the seed itself is neutral. If you do a non-virtuous action, the seed itself is neutral, yeah? But the karma itself, the action itself, is either virtuous or non-virtuous or neutral. There's a whole section in this in volume 3, which some of you proofread, I think, or maybe not. Okay, then somebody said, well, what about true sufferings? So someone said, we seem to assume that all impermanents are true sufferings. Are all impermanents, all impermanent phenomena, true sufferings? Right, the Buddha's mind is not. Okay? So all impermanents are not true sufferings. Some of them are. Okay? Now, somebody said, but what about, you know, our beneficial states of mind, love, compassion? Aren't they impermanent and they aren't true sufferings? Is that true? Why not?
They're still contaminated because of the self-grasping.
They're still contaminated. So if these are virtuous mental factors in the continuum of an ordinary being, they're still polluted. Contaminated is the word you read in books. Polluted is the word we say here. Okay? Okay? So it's, you know, in an ordinary being, even virtuous mental factors are true sufferings or true dukkha and true causes because they are under the influence of ignorance. Because our ordinary minds, you know, even we make an offering, we're seeing everything as inherently existent. Okay? So remember, virtuous and unpolluted are not synonymous. Okay, now we should ask, how many possibilities are there between virtuous and unpolluted? Okay, three, well, let's see. Okay, so what is both virtuous and unpolluted? Yeah, so the wisdom directly realizing emptiness. So that's in the mental continuum of an arhat. Arya. Thank you. Is there something that is unpolluted but not virtuous?
The emptiness of the Buddha's mind, is that virtuous or is that just neutral?
Emptiness is usually neutral. Yeah? So
even the emptiness of anything is neutral?
Yeah.
Okay. So I would say emptiness.
Okay. So then you would say emptiness is unpolluted, but it's not virtuous. Is there something that is virtuous but not unpolluted? Yeah, all of the virtuous mental factors, whatever, of ordinary beings are virtuous, but they're not unpolluted. Is there something that is neither virtuous nor unpolluted? Okay, so seeds of non-virtuous karma, yeah. Okay, so 4P. So to be a true dukkha, it doesn't need to be non-virtuous. Okay, the table is a true dukkha. Yeah, the thermos is a true dukkha. Why? Because these things came into existence under the influence of afflictions and karma. Okay, so that would be another example. There's something that they're true dukkha, but the objects themselves are neutral. Okay, so to be true dukkha, it doesn't have to be negative. In fact, there can be virtuous things that are true dukkha and neutral objects that are true dukkha. What's an example of a virtuous thing that is true dukkha?
Compassion in the mind of an ordinary being.
Okay, compassion in the mind of an ordinary being. What's an example of something that's neutral and true dukkha? The thermos. My glasses. Okay.
Venerable, is polluted and unpolluted defined differently in different schools also?
Probably, because the definition of ignorance can be different in different schools. Some people say that, but other people say, yeah, some people do. I think the Vaivasikas say that. Yeah. Yeah. But we would also agree that it's polluted because it was produced under the influence of afflictions and karma. Past the polluted, the neutral and polluted mic to her.
So when we say that an object is produced under the influence of ignorance and the afflictions, is that in the mind of the perceiver?
No, it means in our world that we live in, you know, all of us ordinary beings, our karma went into producing the physical world. Okay, so all these things are under the influence of afflictions and karma.
Even for an Arya being, they're polluted. I would have thought that Even for an Arya being, that object is polluted. I would have thought that. For an Arya being, the object wouldn't be polluted because of its relative to the unpolluted mind stream. But
not all mind streams are of Aryas are unpolluted. The wisdom in meditative equipoise on emptiness is, but when they're walking around and they have the appearance of true existence, okay, that's under the influence of the latencies of ignorance. So that's still considered polluted. Okay, so the virtuous mental factors of ordinary sentient beings, they're true dukkha and they're true causes. They're both. Then somebody asked, we wondered if there are permanent phenomena that are true dukkha. And someone gave the example of uncomposed space inside a bottle when you're thirsty. Okay, so there's two kinds of space. Okay, there's unconditioned space, and then there's conditioned space, or uncompounded space and compounded space. Okay, the uncompounded space is permanent. That's the space that is simply the absence of obstruction. So that one is permanent. It's a negative phenomena. It's the absence of an obstruction. Okay. The space inside the bowl is it's called conditioned or compounded space because it's an area that was created by, you know, the boundary of the bowl. Okay? So not all space is permanent. I know, it sounds weird, but that's what they say. Okay? Then I thought about, okay, well, what, you know, are there other permanent phenomena that could be polluted? And in thinking about it, what I came up with is, this is just my thought, is that, for example, the emptiness of inherent existence of an ordinary being's consciousness, yeah, that emptiness itself is not polluted, but it's said to be stained or polluted in some sense because it's the emptiness of a polluted object, which is that mind stream. Okay? So I don't know, they say, you know, I don't know if they use the word polluted or what it is, but this is how they differentiate the emptiness of the mind of an ordinary being and the emptiness of the mind of a Buddha. Yeah? Because in one way, they're the same. They're both the emptiness of inherent existence. In another way, they're very different because one's the emptiness of a polluted mind. You know, the other's the emptiness of a purified mind. So it would seem to me that maybe this is just how I'm thinking, that the emptiness of polluted objects, I don't know if you would necessarily call them true dukkha because the emptiness itself isn't produced by afflictions and karma. But it is under the influence of affliction and karma in the sense that it's the emptiness of an object that is. But in any case, that emptiness of a polluted object is something to be abandoned. Yeah, because for Buddha, the Buddha has only purified objects, so those emptinesses of those objects are also purified. So that's how I'm thinking about it. Other people may have other thoughts we can discuss. Yeah.
I could think of a couple examples of permanent things that are true dukkha. One would be a conceptual appearance in the mind of a ordinary being who adheres to the sutra school.
Or just, let's say, a conceptual appearance of negativity, you know, of an enemy.
Yeah.
That would be something that's permanent.
And the also, the other could be non-cow.
Yeah, non-cow.
Or non-Buddha.
I was thinking about the thing you were saying about the gong. Mm-hmm. And I think the way I understand this is that uncompounded space is something that we conceive of, and you don't see it. So,
no.
So when you talk about the space inside of that, it's mm-hmm. impermanent. It's something that we see.
We see,
but
right.
uncompounded space also is within that space.
Right.
But you're not something you're seeing. You're conceiving it.
Right.
And as long as that gong, it's like a temporary one, because as long as the gong exists, you could talk of the uncompounded space that's in there, but you
right.
never would see it because it's not something you see.
Right. Okay, we're done with all that? Yeah? I might quiz you next week to see if you remember anything, because you're not remembering it from 5 minutes ago.
I have yeah. a question about conceptual appearance.
Uh-huh.
It seems that sound generality and meaning generality would both qualify as conceptual appearances. So then meaning generality and conceptual
meaning
appearance.
Meaning generality, what's the term for it?
That's what I'm comparing the terms, actually.
Yeah.
So conceptual appearance and meaning generality then would not be mutually inclusive. One would be 3P to the other, because conceptual appearance would also cover sound generality, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't know. Sound generality is the idea you get of something when you hear the word. Okay. So is that idea that you get of something, is that a meaning, if we go back, is that a meaning generality?
It's not a meaning generality, but you could have a conceptual appearance. That's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Conceptual appearance seems like it could be divided into two things, meaning generality and sound generality.
Because of the way the word is being used.
Because they both could appear to conceptually to the mind from either mm-hmm. way that those two can mm-hmm. appear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Need meaning yeah. generality when you're speaking of those terms, because they break them up into different ones. But other than that, it seems like better to use the conceptual appearance.
Yeah. Yeah, because we don't often use the term sound generality.
There's also a type generality. There's other
Other yeah,
kinds
there's
of
other kind
so
of generalities.
Because you're discerning all these different things. But in the discussion that we're usually talking about, which is about an inference or a conceptual mind, then
yeah.
you don't really need that distinction.
Yeah, then we would say conceptual appearance. So let's keep it like that.
I asked a question about what you've been teaching us on tonight.
Uh-huh.
My mind is not working very quickly. I don't know how, when we're talking about this, like, how would you define true dukkha?
Okay, so true dukkha is usually, you know, whatever comes into existence independent upon ignorance and its latencies, or at least by ignorance. Sometimes, yeah, I'm thinking of the mental bodies of Aryas. I don't think you would. They're produced by the latencies of polluted karma, but I don't know that you would call them true dukkha. That I don't know. Write it down on the Geshe question list. A good question for Geshe Dado, you know, or any of the Geshes that come. Okay, then Christina did some research that I thought I would read to you about conceptions. And Venerable Sepal has, you know, she found that, Christina sent that article in her thing. Okay, but I'll read Christina's because it's shorter. In the last debate class, we talked about how conceptual appearances are permanent. because they are understood by a negative root, which is accomplished by eliminating all that is other than what is understood by the term. Okay? By the term of thought, she said. I mentioned that I had learned something similar in a college psychology class, and you asked me to look into it. I did a brief survey of current theories about concept formation and object recognition, and came across only one that proposes that the mind-brain identifies objects based on its negative properties. In other words, on what it is not. So most of the things you found said that we identified things in a positive way. And that's how we usually think, yeah? The majority of theories hold that concept formation involves the search for and listing of positive attributes that can be used to distinguish exemplars from non-exemplars of various categories. In case you're interested in hearing more about this theory, in the 60s, some researchers built a computer program called Elementary Perceiver and Memorizer, EPOM, to model human learning and recall. So cognitive psychologists often devise and test theories by designing artificial intelligence that supposedly mimics human cognition, which never made much sense to me. Okay. Anyway, EPOM, Elementary Perceiver and Memorizer. It identifies objects using discrimination nets that identify the object based largely on what it is not. For example, a newly encountered object is compared to an image stored in the memory, and if it is not found to be the same thing, the process continues down a chain of exclusion until the object is positively identified. Yeah? So that's kind of what I was trying to say at the beginning. Critics of this model claim that identifying objects based on their negative properties is counterintuitive and psychologically impossible. No, implausible. It seems counterintuitive that people typically recognize things using negative information. Yeah, and it does, you know, because it seems like, oh, you have to go through all existence, everything you've ever realized, to realize it's not that. I mean, how long would that take? Okay. This would be similar to walking into a room and identifying something as a chair because it does not fly and it does not have gills. People primarily appear to recognize things using positive information. Notably, the major models of stimulus structure proposed by psychologists do not employ negative properties. So, based on what little I could find, I'd say the current psychological theories about concepts are not in line with the idea presented in the debate book that concepts represent the exclusion of all that is other than what is being understood.
That book, Knowledge Liberation, has mm-hmm. one sentence. I only reread the first half of that chapter that you referred to with how babies learn. Mm-hmm. That's what this is about. And actually, there's one sentence in that first half that says, this is implicit. Implicit.
What is implicit?
This process is implicit, not explicit. Explicit mm-hmm. would be what we're all thinking it is. I'm negating this, negating this, isn't negating it? This.
Yeah.
But they say it's implicit. And they also, in that book somewhere, talk about that we do this. It seems like we do it both ways. There were parts in there it seems like we were using both.
Okay. Could you get the book and mark the pages?
Sure.
Shall we go on? Now that we are totally confused about concepts. And I always think it's funny, the Tibetan translators always say conceptual thoughts. What else would it be? To me, that seems like a redundant term, because you never have a non-conceptual thought. But I also thought about it, that the word thought is like the word reflection. It can refer to the object, or it could refer to the thing that's reflecting the object. So a thought, you know, we usually think a thought, you know, I mean, we say, okay, I'm thinking of X, Y, and Z. So we think of thought as a consciousness. Or we say object of thought. But then sometimes you say, what is it? My thought is that da 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 da. And there it seems like thought refers to the object that you're thinking about. Yeah? Like the word reflection can refer to the mirror, or it could refer to the thing that is reflected. I see my reflection in the mirror. There, reflection refers to the object. Yeah. But they usually, when they're talking about reflections, are referring to the mirror. Anyway, okay, just my vocabulary lesson of how ambiguous language is. Okay, so I think we were on the section that says direct perceivers. Okay, so now we got to go back to being satantrikas. Okay. Although conceptual consciousnesses may be completely reliable and correct, it is direct perceivers that are held up as the most reliable and accurate consciousnesses. They are called direct perceivers because they realize their objects directly without depending on the appearance of an internal image. Okay, so here, that there you can see what the definition of directly has to do for this school. It's very different for Prasangikas. The actual object appears to a direct perceiver, not in a representative way, but nakedly. On the other hand, a thought consciousness might be called an indirect consciousness because it gets at its objects indirectly in a representative manner only by means of an appearing internal generality. A direct perceiver is defined as a non-mistaken knower that is free from conceptuality. Okay, so now he's going to dissect the different parts of it. So a direct perceiver is a knower, meaning that it's a sort of consciousness. Okay, such a consciousness is non-mistaken in regard to both what appears to it and what it understands. Okay, so what appears to it is unmistaken. What it understands is also unmistaken. So this is Satantrika. What do Prasangikas say? The appearance is mistaken. Yeah, what you can understand the object in a non-mistaken way, but the appearance is mistaken. Why?
It appears
to be truly existent. So the only consciousness of sentient beings to which things do not appear truly existent is Anarya's meditative equipoise on emptiness. So even 10th ground bodhisattvas have mistaken appearance, though very light. Okay. The eye consciousness can see the blue of the sky, and it is the blue of the sky that it understands. Direct perceivers are free from conceptuality, meaning that they do not know their objects by way of an internal image, but contact them directly. So you can see this school. You can get a feeling for this school and how concrete everything is. Yeah? There's a real object out there and a real subject in here that I have direct perception of this that is 100% non-mistaken. Yeah? Because they don't see the appearance of true existence as an object of negation. They think the appearance of true existence exists. Yeah? And we generally agree with them, don't we? Yeah? Oh, we talk about philosophy, but, you know, during the day, how are we? Oh, yes, everything appears inherently existent, and that is right. It is. Because all my perceptions are, you know, that exist objectively out there exactly as it's appearing to me. Yeah. And Nagarjuna says, hey, you better check again. That's not right. What do you think, Mudita? She says, whatever my mood is, it's inherently existent, and it's correct. It's the correct response to whatever I experience. Don't we feel that way? However we respond to a situation is the definitely correct response, the only one a person with intelligence could possibly have towards that experience. Yeah. Who needs to build external prisons? We've built a mental one, haven't we? Yeah. Okay. Do not think that direct perceivers are the same as sense perceptions. We usually do. Why? Because we are so attached to objects of the senses that we don't think of things that can be perceived by another kind of direct perceiver that aren't sense consciousnesses. Okay? So do not think that direct perceivers are the same as sense perceptions. First of all, at least according to Buddhists, the mental consciousness too may function as a direct perceiver. Second, direct perceivers are always accurate, true perceptions, but you may easily observe that not all of your sense perceptions are accurate and true. Oh, really? What's an example, not of a textbook sense example of a sense perception that you had that wasn't true? What's one that you actually had?
Feeling like you're moving when you're not after you've been in the waves of water all day because your inner ear is screwed up. Mm. Or being on a boat all day and then you get off and you feel like you're moving still.
Yeah.
Because your inner ear isn't getting right. Accurate information.
Yeah.
I was sitting on the roof at Root Institute one time looking out into a field and I saw this object that was making like a infinity sign. It just kept going back and forth. And mm-hmm. I thought, what a crazy bird. Look at that bird. And I watched it for the longest time because I couldn't figure out what it was. And finally, and it was white and a kind of a dark background. Finally, I figured out it was a cow tail.
Yeah. I actually have these a lot when I'm walking in the forest. I'll see something dark brown on the path ahead. And is that a bird? Is it a clump of dirt? Is it a bunny? You know? And sometimes you think it's one thing and then you think it's dirt and then it flies away. Yeah. So if you look, we actually have, I don't know about you, but I have, you know, wrong perceptions quite a lot. Yeah. When we mishear what somebody said, when you heard this morning that you thought I said she was drooling. Okay. So, yeah. So that's another example. Yeah.
If you see something and you're seeing it, but you're not figuring out what it is that necessarily the sense perception that's mistaken, or is that the mental consciousness that can't figure out what's coming in?
I think it's probably more the mental consciousness.
Where a sense perception being inaccurate would be like seeing two moons because something was wrong with your eye.
Yeah.
I remember waking up once in a forest on a steep hill, looking at a steep green hill, and I could not figure out for the life of me what I was looking at because I had been asleep a while. It looked like a green wall right there. And then I realized, oh, it's the hillside across the valley.
But sometimes, you know, it does seem like it appears to our sense consciousness like a green wall.
Yeah. and then I couldn't make sense of it for 10 seconds.
Okay, one classic example of a sense misperception in Indian thought is seeing white snow as blue. How often in India did they see snow? I don't care what color. Yeah, only in one area, you know, in the Himalaya area, most of it. In certain lighting conditions, the white snow appears to the eye to be blue. We know this is a matter of the way in which the water molecules of the snow reflect the subdued light. In fact, even the camera records the color of the snow in that light as blue. Why, you know, does the snow change color? I mean, the light is different. Doesn't that, I don't know, I always wonder, when you look outside at a tree, if you look at a leaf, and part of it's in the shade and part of it's in the sun, which is the color green? Yeah, the part in the shade or the part in the sun? Yeah, can you say that one is a wrong consciousness? I don't know which color you could say it really is.
I had a really shocking experience with how color is not inherent. Mm-hmm. So I have, I wear a retainer at night, a mouth guard, and mm-hmm. the case is bright yellow. But then I stayed in someone's room where they had a black light, and I pulled out the case, and it was red. And I was shocked. I said, what is going on here? But then it made me realize there's no yellow inherent in the case. It's a combination of the light.
Yeah,
the case or whatever.
Right. That's why I'm wondering, you know, can you say the snow's really white? Or is this the color of the snow depends on what light it's seen in? Yeah. Yeah, especially if a camera, you know, shows that. Okay. Okay. In fact, even the camera records the color of the snow in that light as blue. However, if you look closely, the snow is invariably white. This example does not always sit well with the scientific mind. That's what we just experienced, though it may continue to be the standard. There are many more examples. If you are watchful, you will likely note a sensory misperception within the next hour. Yesterday, when I looked at lunch and there were these dark brown things, I thought, that looks like pork and ugh. But it was precepts and I had to eat something. So I ate it. It wasn't pork, but my instant reaction was, that's pork, and it's like, ugh, yeah. Or it's other things we can think of too, which are equally ugh. So if you are watchful, you will likely note a sensory misperception within the next hour. If you want to make one now, just manipulate your lower eyelid while looking at a light and notice that it appears that there are two lights. This effect is due to the play of the light. Though you might wonder if the color of the snow is really blue in that setting, you will not wonder whether or not you actually have two of those lamps. Thus, sense perceptions may or may not be right, and only some of them are direct perceivers. So some of them are inattentive, some of them are wrong. Corresponding to the primary division of consciousnesses into sense and mental consciousnesses, that's the way he divided it, direct perceivers fall into two groups, sense direct perceivers and mental direct perceivers. So I like the way he used the word perceivers, yeah, instead of perception. And I like that because perceivers refers to the agent that is doing the perceiving. Perception, to me anyway, refers to the object you're seeing. Because we often say direct perception, you know, or conceptual, you know, we'll say direct perception, but you know, it's actually direct perceivers. It's referring to the thing that's doing the perceiving. So I like that he uses that here. There are five types of sense direct perceivers corresponding to the five sense consciousnesses. So he uses the terms eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body sense consciousnesses. I prefer to use visual, auditory, and so on. Consciousnesses of all types are impermanent phenomena. And in the case of directly perceiving consciousnesses, their explicit objects are also impermanent phenomena, objects that disintegrate moment by moment. Thus, some have raised the qualm that since consciousnesses last for only a moment, and their objects too are momentary phenomena, how can a sense consciousness know any object? You know, because it's all happening so quickly. One Buddhist answer is, what we experience as sense perception is actually a continuum of moments of consciousness, apprehending a continuum of moments of an object, which is disintegrating moment by moment. Yeah? And so here you can see why we relate to objects as if they're permanent, you know, or at least subtly permanent. You know, we'll talk about gross impermanence, but we definitely don't think about subtle impermanence because, you know, we're perceiving, a whole stream of mind moments of an object that is changing every moment. But because we're so gross, our sense consciousnesses are so gross, we don't see the momentary change in the object. And so then, you know, when we talk about the four distortions, one of them is seeing impermanent things as permanent. And so there you can see why that happens. Because just on the level of our senses, we don't see the subtle change. So this is, you know, when you do mindfulness meditation, the Buddhist mindfulness, one of the things when as your concentration deepens is you begin to be able to see the changing moments of the object. Yeah. And you come in touch with subtler and subtler things, all the different changes in the object, and you know that your mind is changing moment by moment too. And so therefore you can have a yogic direct perceiver of subtle impermanence, because with that mental consciousness, you actually see the momentary changes of something. So clearly that takes a level of concentration that I don't know about you, but I don't have. Okay? Yeah? So usually in our tradition, we think of subtle, we come to understand subtle impermanence by using logic, by using reasoning, you know. And the one His Holiness likes is the sun rises over there and it sets over there, you know, but the only way it gets from here to there is subtle momentary changes that we don't see. Although, when you watch I don't know if any of you saw the moonrise last night. It was just coming up when I did something. Anyway, how you can see the moon coming up over the horizon. Yeah.
When you say the yogic direct perceiver perceives subtle impermanence, and you say sees.
That's it doesn't mean visual
not visually,
seeing.
Yeah.
It means mentally seeing.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to be sure.
Yeah. We very often use the word see when it doesn't refer to the visual thing. Like somebody is explaining an idea to you, and you say, I see. But you're not seeing anything with your eyes. Yeah. So this is just how our language works. Okay. Consciousnesses of all types are impermanent phenomena, and in the case of directly perceiving consciousnesses, their explicit phenomena are also impermanent phenomena, objects that disintegrate moment by moment. Thus, some have raised the qualm that since consciousnesses last only for a moment and their objects, too, are momentary. We already read this, didn't we? Okay, next paragraph. There is some bias on the part of those who seem to suggest that direct perceivers are dumb consciousnesses, like a bias in favor of the life of the mind. Okay, you know, how we honor, you know, the ability to think and take different ideas and different things and relate them together and talk about them, you know. So if you treasure that, then you look at sense. If you're only thinking of sense, direct perceivers, then they seem kind of dumb, you know, because they see color and shape and hear sound, but they don't understand, you know, things relate together. Okay, so he says this is not a bias shared by Buddhists who think it is possible for sense perceptions to have remarkable clarity. Sense consciousnesses are also capable of comprehending their object's ability to perform a function. Thus, an eye consciousness itself can perceive that fire has the ability to cook and burn. But the idea here is that the visual consciousness can see that fire can perform that function. Here we're not talking about the definition of fire, but the function of fire. Okay? So, you know, I used to think of that and go, "Nah, I'm not so sure." But in this case of fire, yeah, our eye consciousness can see that something is burning in fire. So it can see that, you know, something is changing. So I guess in that way you would say it sees that fire burns, performs the function of burning. Yeah. Now, does our eye consciousness see that the thermos performs the function of holding water? Probably only if you unscrew it and you see water at the same time you see the thermos.
But if you know that object very well, then as soon as you see it, would your eye consciousness know that it has that function?
That's what they seem to be suggesting. In fact, they seem to suggest that if you know the object very well, you see the object instead of not just seeing the color and shape and then labeling that what the object is. Okay.
So when you say you see the object, do you mean you see the conceptual appearance, or you?
No. They would say with your eyes. See, this is where this system. Well, you know already. I have some problems with it. You know, they say, okay. Let's keep reading because it gives an example. I can tell you haven't read ahead. Okay, therefore, direct perceivers do not merely register sensory input, but are non-mistaken knowers capable of realizing their objects. Okay, but when they say that the visual consciousness sees color and shape, it sounds like it's just registering sensory input, and it can identify that color and shape. Anyway, keep listening. Although direct perceivers may induce conceptuality, they themselves are totally free of conceptuality. Such consciousnesses do not name or classify their objects. Do not name or classify their objects, because that would involve conceptually concept, but experience them apart from conceptually determining types and so forth. This is where I wonder, how does that happen? But keep reading. Still, this does not mean that direct perceivers are not aware of their object's qualities. Sense consciousnesses can also be trained such that an eye consciousness can know not only that a person being seen is a man, but also that that person is one's father. Now, Okay? That seems to imply that if you're very familiar with the object, that you can identify that it's your father without any concept, because it's a direct perceiver, that your visual consciousness can know that's your parent without any concept. Yeah. And he says you have to train it like that. You know, see, and so here is where I have some problem, because they say, what are the objects of a visual consciousness? Color and shape. But, you know, your parent is not color and shape. Okay? First of all, in fact, you're seeing your parent's body. You're not seeing your parent. And second of all, their body is not color and shape.
I tried to find this reference. I think it was in this book where he made a distinction between seeing and apprehending. And I don't remember which way it went. Does that ring a bell? He was saying you can, using one of those words, you can see the shape and color of a person or a person's body, but you can apprehend person. Do you remember this distinction?
Oh, well, that's when we were talking about to know a person, you have to first contact something that is not the person, such as its body, the body.
Right, but there was a very clear distinction between the use of these two words, see and apprehend. And you would see, or I don't remember which way it went, but one word seemed to be used specifically for the shape and the color of the object, and the other one was for what you can understand. Like, it would be ridiculous to say we can't see a person, right? They'd lock us up if we started talking like that. Yeah. But at the same time, what we're actually seeing is the shape and the color of the person's body.
Right. But I wonder, you know, how can you see a function? I mean, in the example of fire, okay, you see that the fuel changed. So you know that the fire has the power to burn something. Anyway, it's just something to think about, you know. When you see things or apprehend things, I don't care, we look and we say, this is white, okay? Or before we even say it's white, we look and we know it's white. Yeah? So,
to train ourselves to stay with the seeing, just not have so much conceptuality in the way, and then we'd have a better idea of what we would know, because they are knowers.
Yeah, they are knowers, but you know, it's sometimes hard to distinguish, you know, these things. Anyway, so it's something to think about. Yeah. But then you just know it, yeah. But then you can't communicate to anybody. Okay, although direct perceivers may induce conceptuality, they themselves are totally free of conceptuality. Okay, a sense consciousness would not conceive that its object is one's father, but it may induce a conceptual consciousness that affixes names, determines types, remembers associations, and so forth. In this way, people are drawn into conceptuality, quickly abandoning the richness of direct perception in favor of mental imagery and abstraction. Impermanent phenomena appear nakedly to direct perceivers. However, ordinary beings do not perceive them nakedly, because, one, generally these objects maintain a continuum of a similar type moment by moment, and thereby appear to persist. And two, such beings are under the influence of predisposition for naming objects. Okay, but, you know, we don't have to, concept doesn't mean you have to give something a name. It just means you put the parts together and joined it as something. Yeah, which is why I wonder, how can you say that your visual consciousness does that? Another mystery. Okay, let me just see. Okay, we'll finish this section. The second group of direct perceivers are mental direct perceivers. And again, these are of several types. Included among these is mental direct perception in the continuums of ordinary beings. The Galupas assert that at the end of the of a continuum of sense direct perception of an object, there is generated one moment of mental direct perceiver. This in turn induces conceptual cognition of that object, naming it, and so forth. So you have that one moment of mental direct perceiver after your visual consciousness sees the thing. Okay. But it's happened so fast that we don't even know it. Okay. Such mental direct perceivers serve to link the knowledge of raw sense data to conceptual consciousnesses that notice, name, determine types, and so forth. Lasting only an instant, these mental direct perceivers are too ephemeral for an ordinary person to notice. However, they are ascertained by advanced practitioners who have more stable and insightful awareness, so who have deep levels of concentration. The most important type of direct perceivers are yogic direct perceivers, a kind of mental direct perceiver that is a non-conceptual direct realizer of such profound objects as subtle impermanence and selflessness, or more specifically, the mind and body qualified as selfless. Such yogic direct perceivers may be cultivated through engaging in meditative practice. The yogi first understands, for instance, subtle impermanence conceptually. Then, through continued and sustained familiarization with that conceptual realization, the meditator is able to bring the image appearing to that inferential cognizer, that is, a conceptual appearance of subtle impermanence, into exceptionally clear focus. Having cultivated a conceptual understanding to the peak of its capacity, the yogi eventually passes beyond the need for a representative image of what is understood and develops a direct perception of the object, a mental direct perception of the object. These yogic direct perceivers are the most exalted of all knowers, being able to realize the profound truths in a totally unmistaken manner. They are the actual antidote to ignorance, which Buddhists assert to be the source of all suffering in cyclic existence. Thus, the achievement of yogic direct perceivers is the goal of all Buddhist reasoning. Okay, so that's an important point. If we use reasoning, the goal isn't to win the object and have the best conceptions and blah, blah. It's to get a correct conceptual appearance so that through meditation you can pierce that conceptual appearance and see the object directly. Okay? But you can see here, you know, yogic direct perceivers, yeah, that's what we want. But how often do we think about them? When we hear direct perceivers, we always think of sense perceivers, don't we? We totally space about yogic direct perceivers. And so that's why, you know, we tend to like conceptuality, because that gives us a lot of information about the object because we don't know it directly yet. But conceptuality is the way to learn about those objects, you know. Otherwise, you walk into a meditation center and they say, close your eyes and realize the ultimate nature, emptiness, and you'd be able to do it. Yeah. But we actually have no idea what that ultimate nature emptiness is. So if we're asked to do that, then we just invent our own ideas of emptiness. Yeah. So that's why study is important, so that we learn exactly what that word refers to, so that we can identify what the ultimate nature is accurately. But we don't want to stay in words forever.
Mm-hmm. It would seem then that you have that you could have two different kinds of direct perceivers, though, or those that precede mental consciousnesses, and like you visually see something, and then that induces a conceptual consciousness. Mm-hmm. And those that are induced by a conceptual consciousness, such as the yogic direct mm-hmm. perceiver.
Yeah, you can say that. Usually when they classify direct perceivers, they say sense direct perceivers, mental direct perceivers, and yogic direct perceivers. That's the usual classification. Right. Yeah.
And with the sense direct perceivers, I see that without them being able to induce some kind of a conceptual consciousness, they could be next to useless.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Where the school what seeming to favor them and treat them exaltedly, but yeah. It seems like they're...
See, but that's why when he says that you can see with your sense direct perceiver the function of the object, you know, that's why I'm a little bit puzzled. Yeah.
It seems to me like you can see stuff with your eyes, like you can see an object burning, mm-hmm. which is the data that lets your mental consciousness understand that something's burning. But it seems to me like it's the mental consciousness that understands it.
It does to me too, but that's not the way the tradition says it.
It's not what they're saying.
Yeah. It's not what they're saying. It's not what... Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think I started this off with I have some trouble with the tantricas. So, yeah. So, so another thing is to ask, to investigate, is are the Tibetans understanding the Satantrika view the way the Satantrika said it? You know? Which is another topic.
One book that's translated into English and then we cling to it like that's the view.
Yeah.
And that's just one yiksha or one person's point of view
right.
from his study. So,
yeah, but if we have, right, the Srivasti Abhi yiksha, then we have to have some reasons for saying things, you know? Then we need to translate the word yiksha, first of all. Yeah. Sometimes they translate it as manual, but it's not a manual. It can be a whole big text.
This is a Drepung. He was a Drepung scholar. And
Lati Rinpoche is from Jiangse. But he's from Jiangse, but Jiangse and Losa Ling both follow Panchen Sonam Drakpa.
Okay. So I was asking, when I was talking with Venerable Tenzin Palmo, the Czech nun at Kopan, and we were talking about this, how you would debate things that are just from a different yiksha's point of view. And she said, yeah, but the challenge for English readers is that we don't have the Sarah J. point of view or their yiksha's in English. And I said, well, you need to translate it then.
Yeah. So, well, sometimes, I mean, when I first heard teachings on this, it was from Geshe Jampa Tekchok, and he used the Sarah J. yiksha. So we didn't have anything translated in English. We just had to write it down as, you know, it came out. Yeah, anyway, many different viewpoints, and that's just even within the Galupas. Now imagine, you know, you broaden that to Nyingma Kagyu and Sakya, and then you broaden it to, you know, the Chinese and the Theravada. But what's very interesting is, you know, there are certain similarities because they say this is from Satantrika, but the Tibetans basically rely on Sarvastivada, yeah, which was, you know, the Sarvastivada interpretation of many things. So that's, you know, I just have some questions about how all these supposed schools and things came into being and, you know, and if they're as discreet as they sound, I don't think so. You know, from what I've gathered, you know, you had Satantrikas and Chittamadrans living together. They got along. You know, they weren't fighting over their whether they have a mind basis of all. And even bodhisattvas and shravakas lived together in olden times, and they didn't fight over bodhicitta, you know, and who was selfish and who wasn't. Because, yeah. So, you know, a lot of this, I think, is kind of a pedagogical tool, you know. It just sets up something with a standard view that in some way may resemble something in the past. Yeah. I mean, they did have schools in the past, but, you know, I don't think somebody invented the Sautantrika school and set out as a catechism. That's not how things happen. You know, things happen very organically.
You maybe tie this in. Why is it that they have different takes on the Abhidharma?
Because there were 18 different schools, and everything was oral. So, you know, and remember, they say 18 different schools, but there are actually more. And the way they classify the schools, there's about 4 or 5 different interpretations, but each one's right. Yeah. So, yeah. So there's all these different schools, and because it's an oral tradition, then things got passed down slightly differently, and especially with Abhidharma, where they can't even agree among the schools who spoke the Abhidharma. Some say it was the Buddha. He came down from after teaching his mother in the God realm, each day, and he gave the Abhidharma he taught to his mother, to Shariputra, so it's the words of the Buddha. Other people say it's Arhats that wrote it, the Abhidharma text. Other people say just scholars of some sort wrote it, you know?
the Tibetans go by the first one?
I don't
know. Is it broken down by, in the present day times, would you say the Theravadas and the Tibetans have completely different views on this?
The Theravadas really? And the Tibetans both say that there's seven Abhidharmic texts. But when they list the seven, there's only one in common. Okay? So I was reading at one point some Abhidharma material from the Pali, and it was interesting. There's some things that overlap with what we study, but the Tibetans say, well, we're studying Vaibhasika, and other people say, no, that's actually mostly Savastivada. The Tibetans say that the 18 schools are all classified under Vaibhasika. Everybody else says that the Vaibhasika is one branch of the Srivastavada. I think the Chinese agree with the Pali there. So, I don't know. You could write a PhD thesis on this. Yeah, and then you can read it after we read her water. Okay, so how about if we dedicate? Now, Abhidharma is quite difficult to sit down and read an Abhidharma text. Oh, my goodness. But, you know, whoever wrote it, it's quite useful, you know, in terms of breaking down categories and things like that. But to read it, I don't know. Yeah, if you're looking for a particular point and you have a good index, that's good. Yeah, then it's very helpful to find what you're looking for.